Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello.
Justin Robert Young.
Oh, yeah, baby, we're back.
Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hello, I'm happy to be back in normal time, in the normal flow of time. The space-time continuum has been smoothed out. We are now back
well,
in space.
Tell you what, in the reentry, you got a smart new haircut, Bryce.
Thank you. Looks good. I've been doing a reverse growing it out. Every week or so, I've been cutting another inch or so off. But you don't get to tell. It's certainly not in the audio version of this podcast. You can't really tell very much.
Well, just imagine a real smart haircut.
Thank you.
And then please draw it on whatever you have. Just think of whatever is in your head, and then just send it to what are you on Twitter? At Brycas.
Yeah, BRYCAS.
Yeah, send your what you imagine Bryce's haircut to look like.
It's kind of like he just passed that Gary Oldman Fifth Element phase.
Yeah, it's back. It's back to the Gary Oldman level, for sure.
So, gentlemen, while we were scattered to the four winds, some interesting things happened. SpaceX launched, I think, last week, their Starlink, the first group of 60 Starlink satellites. These are part of their plan. They want to be able to provide global internet around the world, ultimately with thousands of satellites in low Earth orbit with really low latency, which would maybe even allow you to connect faster than fiber optic. It's part of their plan for one of the big ways of earning revenue for SpaceX. So they did their first test launch of 60 satellites, and they launched in what was they called kind of like a star train, because they all came out of one launcher, and they started to spread out. And it was a very beautiful sight to behold as these things started to unfold. And they have kind of, as typical SpaceX, their own design. Instead of the classic two solar panels, they each have one solar panel. They're using ion thrusters with krypton gas to help them reach their altitude. And it was a beautiful launch, you know, incredible technology. As all things Musk, not without controversy. Once these satellites went up, 60 of them in a row, when they're bundled together as they head towards the horizon, you could see a very bright flare, and you could spot this. And astronomers are now going like, what's going to happen when we have thousands of these satellites up there? Now, it should be said that when they first start reaching orbit, they're clustered together and they're easier to spot. And when they're finally spread out, they'll be harder to see, but not impossible. And now there's the concern of what happens with thousands of these things up in space.
I mean, the answer is fairly transparent, right? We move the telescopes outside of low Earth orbit, right?
Well, imagine you're an amateur astronomer. You're a backyard astronomer. You put your telescope in your backyard. You go to locations and you go do that. That's not a practical solution for you. And you know, you have thousands and thousands of people who do this as a hobby. You have researchers and other people. And yes, there will be more space telescopes. But in the meantime, if you're the person with this hobby right now, you know, and you're looking in the next few years, this affecting you might be an impact.
But the good news is you'll have fast access through the internet to the telescopes that are on the outside of this ring of satellites, thanks to this ring of satellites. Am I wrong?
Let's also put this in context, because I would say, I mean, Andrew, you certainly have, an interest in astronomy, but I don't know anybody who has spent more deliberate time out on their back porch looking through a telescope than Brian. So, like, as somebody that this would be more affecting toward you and the kid, your kids that you've instilled a love of astronomy into, like, so this does not bother you at all? You're like, I mean, now we'll just be able to turn on the TV and move our gigantic satellite wherever we want.
That's actually a really good distinction, because I feel like there are tourist level astronomical events. Some of the highlights for me were the first time we busted out the telescope and I used an iPhone to take decent fake pictures of the moon. I remember when we tracked the Venus transit across the sun, I believe a couple of comet sightings. All of these were backyard events that we used a Dobsonian, I think a 10 or 12 inch reflective display on. I don't think any of these hobbyist level events would be affected by a whole cloud of these satellites. I think the people chagrined are the ones who feel like they might have been able to catch the next, you know, extinction level event or the next significant whatever in their backyard. And instead, it's just we're seeing a separation from the theme park crowd, which is me and below, and versus the pro level crowd, which are people who are going to have to subscribe to, you know, the live feed of all of the space telescopes out there.
I think there's a big area between you and that other crowd, though. There, I know people who are hobbyists who spend tens of thousands of dollars a year on equipment and cameras and stuff to go out there and to shoot stuff, and spend a considerable amount of time, you know, leaving their, you know, their telescopes out there doing long range exposures and all that, who aren't pros, but they're very, very active group. And even the pro levels, you know, we have, you know, we have more sophisticated telescopes now, but getting access on that's hard. And when you want to have control and use it, and when you start looking at, you know, there's a miserable percentage of the sky which could be obscured by these. There's a miserable, like, it's like 4 or 5% of the, I forget, you know, I saw one of these things, they showed one of the long range telescopes and how much it's going to, can be obscure. There's been statements from, you know, different astronomical organizations and all that. And let me make this very clear, in case any of you are new to this podcast, I'm like super pro Starlink, very clear. I'm with Brian, like, yay, internet access. But, you know, we need to understand where these people are coming from.
Yeah, you know what? And this is a little bit outside of the tech most people would expect from me. But, you know, we've entered an age where during our lifetime, we regarded the oceans and the skies as essentially a common good that everybody could share, and there was no downside to doing stuff. And now we've entered a phase where, you know, we're looking increasingly at carbon taxes in order to, or some kind of cap and trade system in order to treat this common good in such a way that it makes sure to benefit all people around it. Likewise, for the first time, I'm considering the possibility that maybe visual access to the sky has to be one of those things. Maybe it's the kind of thing where it's like, if you want to cover the sky with 100 million nano satellites that will, on the one hand, bring unprecedented universal communication interior to planet Earth, but on the other side, let's say removed 10% of humanity's visual access to the skies, maybe it's not the craziest thing to consider a visual access tax to shape I guess what you would do is you would collect that money and you would spend it on access to more, either creating more telescopes outside of the we'll say the nano cloud or whatever, outside of the nano cloud, and also to allow access to more people to see outside of that.
Well, you know, some of the research on cap and trade and those proposals show that they have unintended consequences, sometimes make things worse. And one is that the funds don't often end up where they're supposed to. And sometimes you end up incentivizing doing more of the thing you're trying to stop, because once you can earn revenue from doing that. That being said, is the pressure, the public pressure, you know, and Elon Musk respond to this is like, you know, hey, we'd be open to trying to make it more easy to help, you know, SpaceX to help with astronomy. I think the public pressure side of things could be good. You know, the idea of, like, you know, before we try to implement some sort of bureaucratic structure that tries to do this, I certainly think that, you know, we should be, you know, there need to be a conversation with this. What are the solutions? You know, because I think you and I, we agree that, like, the benefit of this is enormous. Yeah. of, you know, helping people in remote regions, and just the more people can get online, the cheaper we get online, the better things are in general. The irony though would be, wouldn't it be funny, wouldn't it be sad if we missed the asteroid that was coming towards us because of Starlink and SpaceX effort to
Well, we'd all be able to post about it. You know, that would be great.
That's part of, and you know me, I'm all the way to possible anarcho-libertarian status here. So it's like, there's nothing about taxation that I love, but if we baked into this new thing that we're doing to change the sky, some kind of benefit that stated its mission was to give us better eyes outside of that cloud, that seems like that would kind of solve it.
I mean, look. Whether or not there is a restitution there, I think we are going to see. But I do think that there is a very interesting moment that we are at right now where research is, of course, important. But if it does come at odds to, like, not only giving people – because this isn't even just about getting people internet in remote areas. Unless I am incorrect, this would also be going over the top of, like, restrictive regimes – who are controlling of their internet,
and,
right?
And like, not only that, that also solves the many of the problems of there are a lot of people here in the United States in rural areas who have to rely on one carrier who has a restrictive monopoly and is able to charge a ton of money to do it. And then outside of that, you have like, what, I don't know, like five dozen satellites from HughesNet that you're paying a bajillion dollars for crappy internet or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, this would be an opportunity. I suppose this is the philosophical question, is would all of us sign off on, let's say there was a 10% reduction, full stop, in all of humanity's ability to see the night sky as our primitive ancestors saw it. But in exchange, we got instant communication all over the globe and we'll say 500 space telescopes that we all had access to. To see the outside world virtually better than ever before. I mean, that seems like something I would sign up for.
If we can bring high-speed access to lesser-developed countries, if we can give the level of access that we have right now to people and make it cheaper for people in poorer countries, that alone would be worth it, just as the sheer benefit that it can bring them. You know, and we've talked about this before, like, cell phones radically changed other countries when making it easier for people to sell goods, bring things to market and whatever, and helps economies. Global internet, you know, has that potential too. So, yeah.
It feels a little bit like, I don't know, the late 1800s in London, where it's like the Industrial Revolution was making possible all kinds of distribution of goods. But in the short term, you had to deal with, like, you know, just the garbagiest, nastiest, you know, horse poop everywhere, soot everywhere, child labor getting ground up in gears all the time. And yet, it's hard to argue that once we're past that phase, all of those innovations were a net benefit to humanity, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not the child in the...
Yeah, no. Look, gears, I'm saying is I'm very much in favor of children being ground up in gears and being lowered down
like yeah, no, 100%.
In wells... Yeah. All of that.
Yeah, I mean, the always on the edges of change. It's always rough. It's always difficult. And you know, I think that, yeah, I'm trying to be sympathetic to the people in astronomy and the amateurs, because it's sometimes just to say like, we'll have space, and that's not the way you're describing the argument. But I mean, in some of the forums, I'm like, we'll have space telescopes, and it's like, great. I don't. What do I do now? You know, and I think that there is a bit of a territorial thing too, though. You know, some of the astronomers, you sort of see some of the comments are kind of like, you know, the priesthood, like, we should decide what happens here, you know.
Yeah, well, because it's been their domain. Nobody has much cared about, you know, stuff aside from a few, you know, commercial and governmental satellites. We have not seen that kind of ramp up to the point where it would affect them. And so now this is not just us looking out into a pastoral view, right? This is now going to be a highway that can bring commerce to the world. And yeah, it'll suck to be like, well, I remember when this was just a beautiful field, poppies as far as the eye could see, instead of like, well, and now there's a road that sure has given people jobs and money and brought us untold you know, unlocked potential, but man, I still remember those poppies.
So yeah. Tali Zarella in the chat says, I've never seen the Milky Way anyway, so I wouldn't even notice. That is kind of a shocking thing for me, and maybe it's because I've done a bit of traveling and here or there have gotten the chance to see the Milky Way, but I don't know that I get, in a world where VR is getting better and better and better to the point where, like, maybe I'm the one who has never seen the Milky Way, and Tally Zarell will be the one who actually sees it through VR goggles once we have 75, 100, 600 space telescopes giving the highest clarity version of it ever. So I don't know. It's as we become this multicellular organism, as we surpass Dunbar's number, I don't know.
Here's the thing. When I saw the full eclipse, the full on, all of a sudden I can stare up at the sun and see that black disk in the sky. Knowing that I was there, knowing that it was such a profound and amazing experience, I think there are going to be some experiences that, even though you could get it in a higher fidelity and whatever to have them digitally or whatever, there's some things that at least the belief that it's real or happening there is so profound.
I could see, though, let's do 200 year futurology. Let's postulate that there are now,
Welcome to Weird Things, episode 20,398.
Yeah, right. There are now 500 space telescopes, and they have an unprecedented level of data. Let's say also that essentially full-on retina display VR is available. Mm-hmm. And let's say a previously unknown drug is able to its only job is to erase the perceived technological boundary between you and what you're perceiving. So the thing you're looking at is the Milky Way, but you're seeing it with 500 eyes, and you're seeing it through a VR headset that matches neuron for neuron, receptor for receptor, pixel for pixel in your eye. And the only thing that keeps you from actually being in space and looking at it is your mental awareness that you are in your room looking through all this stuff. And then imagine a mild drug that just smooths those boundaries, so you are getting a 100% accurate view of the world at the highest fidelity possible. You are, for, let's say, 40 minutes, a human being in space seeing at all ranges of the electromagnetic spectrum. Like, that seems like a net good for humanity to give everybody that experience, right?
I mean, I think what Andrew's saying, though, is that there is the idea that you're looking through a telescope is at least like, all right, all this is a couple mirrors and I'm peering into the sky. There is a physical kind of connection there that maybe you're right, Brian, that like maybe you can, between technology and drugs, kind of hack your brain into being like, OK, well, let's just get to that point through chemistry. But I don't know. I think at the end of the day, this is a very privileged point of view to say, no, but our scholarly research, like that's what we need instead of random people, or not random people in low income areas, like having access to this like global net of prosperity.
I certainly think that, to Brian's point, like someday when we have like the Neuralink and I can plug into, the very large array on the other side of the moon and feel like I am, that'll be amazing. And that'd be cool. And that'll be levels of experiences. And I don't even know if we need our Schwid LSD. I think at some point, that will be a reality. And I can't even comprehend what the experience and things will be like then. And certainly we can talk a little about virtual reality a little bit later, too, because
dun, 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 oh, dun, dun. Save it for after the break.
Yep. I think it's one of the things that I think both sides need to listen to the other ones, just to sort of understand and hear. I think that, understanding, we've had a lot of amazing contributions from amateur astronomers, and also as amateur astronomers are doing some cool stuff, just looking at data, like, images of Mars and looking through there. So, and I think that SpaceX has talked about the idea of trying to see if they can lower the albedo of the satellites to lower the amount of light they give off. And they're trying to be responsive towards that. And I think it's, on one hand going, okay, I hear you. We'll look for ways to mitigate this. But I think ultimately, yeah, internet for everybody is kind of a good thing.
So. How far off are we from the idea of, and we've seen hints of this in other stories, like I think it's 3 seconds after or whatever, about the EMP or whatever. How long until our ghost stories consist of, I once went 8 full days without connection to the internet, and that being a legitimately terrifying story, which, by the way, as I'm saying these words, might be a legitimately terrifying story already right now.
How many of us have friends, though, that like go on retreats or go do stuff and unplug?
Oh, yeah. I mean, a bunch. But I do think that now there is a level of terror. Like, if you were doing a horror movie, right? Like, the moment that you are in the small town and you realize that you can't get onto the internet now is a horror point, in the way that if somebody picked up a phone line and found out that it was dead, like, it just makes you, it removes this kind of umbilical cord to society.
Well, and keep in mind, there was a Sam Harris has a podcast called Making Sense, where he points out that there are people who pay for the privilege of going on 30-day silent retreats where all they do is have their own thoughts. There are other people who are legends in the meditation community for being able to go 6 whole months with nothing but their thoughts. And yet, with cause, with legitimate cause, here in America, throwing somebody in the hole in prison where they're not allowed to talk to anybody and they're only allowed to eat, drink, and have their thoughts is, I think you can easily make a case for that being cruel and unusual punishment. So I don't know when and where that changes.
I don't know. I do think that, like, yeah, you've been to points where all of a sudden you look down at your phone and you realize you have no signal and you feel this disconnection, this, oh my God. And you're like, yeah, most of my life was like that. And yeah. And now you take it for granted. And, you know, I was just in India and I brought with me, 2 phones and a backup phone.
I definitely made sure. It was like the calls that I made before I left for Italy was just to make sure that my AT&T mobile passport was on the line. So I got my same plan for like $10 a day because I didn't want to screw around with any other SIM. I didn't want to screw around with anything else. This is very important that I just got my phone to work in the way that I wanted to.
I was going to say, I could see in a world, like, if we ever get to the point where we could like back ourselves up to the cloud and stuff, the idea of taking vacations in places where you can't do that, where there's, you know, the idea of like, well, if you die there, you're going to lose the last 2 weeks of your life.
Yeah.
Can I confess a fantasy from two days ago?
Yes,
I was trying to think of what framework to do this. And maybe this will turn into something at some point, but I was like, So I've spent 12 years establishing a footprint on the internet and being this guy on various programs and doing my best to get on TV and all that stuff. And then there was a moment that I thought, what would it feel like to just not be that guy and to just go away, spend cash and have a fake ID or maybe buy a fake ID and ride on a motorcycle and get back to a place where my full attention needed to be on where I was present in the moment and not about managing my brand, keeping in mind long-going narratives or tracking the analytics of this thing or that thing. And I got to admit, there was a real appeal to it. And I don't know. Like, do you guys perceive any value in being an unperson for some amount of time? Because, like, there's part of me that thinks, like, what a unique, amazing vacation to just – all the money that you would have spent, you know, in Cancun and all the creature comforts or whatever, instead gets spent in real-time interactions to other people. And you know, maybe even making a game out of it where it's like, I'm going to run in a random direction as far as I can. And the first person to say, hey, Brian Brushwood, you have to go back to work. You're the winner. You get $1,000 cash and I go back to work. Like that, for some reason, like that fantasy held tremendous appeal to me, and I'm really surprised by that.
I'm just sometimes the look inside of your mind, Brian.
I mean, just it's because delightful. it's the opposite. I call it a Brian Crazy Ivan, where it's like every so often I stop and I just look in the exact opposite direction of everything I've worked my whole life for, and I wonder what that might look like. And the best I could come up with is a fantasy vacation where I try to run away and the world catches me.
You know, our first ever weird things, one of the first ever, we did an imagination scenario. I'm like, what if you're the last person alive? And Brian's was, the pants come off. Yeah. No, I hear you. I think that, you know, you wake up every day, and the older you get, the more responsibilities you have, you know, and the more you feel like there's a thing you have to do and you have to keep moving in that direction. It's like you're on a train, and sometimes you just want to jump off the train.
Well, and I don't even mean in like I have a deep-seated desire to do that, but, you know, they call them intrusive thoughts.
Not deep-seated, Brian.
They call them intrusive thoughts.
But Brian, I would not separate the fact that you are currently at a point where however much you were in charge of things a year ago, you are in charge of many more things this year and infinitely more things over the next 2 years. So it's like, I do think that that is probably, I ain't no Siggy Freud here, but like, I'm saying that maybe there is a connection between that blossoming supernova of responsibility and your desire to just hop the rails and take your bindle to where nobody knows, then you can just be checking out your hobo code to see which kindly old lady will feed you a piece of rhubarb.
You're not wrong. That's the, I mean, yes, you got it right on the nose. And I'm very aware of where these ideas come from. But I do think it's fascinating because I used to be of the mindset where it's like, what good is privacy? Who wants privacy, right? But then as I live in this small town and more places that I go to grab a bite to eat, before I have a chance to speak, tell me what they already know I want to eat and drink, I'm just like, well, I suddenly understand the impulse to want to be anonymous, to want to be none of this.
I think it's going to be interesting if we have considerably longer lifespans and we don't feel certain kinds of pressure. I think that it'd be interesting to see that, like, what it means, you know, the sabbaticals and the things and being able to go be different things, do different things, you know, feel like it's not a whimsy to do that would be neat.
I mean, yeah, it's, to be totally honest, throughout my life, I've kind of moved every like 5 or 6 years, you know, it's just been a thing that, like, now we're coming up on like 7 years here in California, and part of me is like, all right, yeah, time to burn my life and cash those chips in somewhere else. Like, let's go. I am done. The first thing I would do when I went to a new town is I would make sure that I still in my budget had money for patreon.com/weirdthings. The best thing about totally abandoning all responsibilities and obligations and moving out to a new place is that you can still have our dulcet tones in your ear. And if you go ahead and subscribe on patreon.com/weirdthings, you can also get our After Things podcast earlier than anybody else does. This is Brian, Andrew, and myself talking about entrepreneurship and making things and living your life as a creator. Folks, it's so simple. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
So we got a cool update from they're right now doing the Worldwide Developers Conference for Apple, which is, you know, the next generation software and everything else is coming out. And one of the things that was really exciting, they announced a couple of them 2 years ago, I think, was ARKit. And ARKit was Apple's version for how to do AR. Google has AR Core, which they've been, you know, supporting really well. And ARKit makes it very easy to pick up your phone and look through it and see things floating in real, you know, looks like really in your environment. And we think that, you know, that's going to lead to the future where we're going to put on, like, you know, Microsoft HoloLenses or other systems and be able to interact with augmented reality. Apple just unveiled some really cool things for this, including if you put a person in the frame, it will model their body. And so if this person moves, it will capture their motions and you can apply it to a object like a robot or something. So it measures your body and also body occlusion. So if, let's say, you wanted to play Minecraft with a friend and you look through the viewer and you see the Minecraft environment, the person would be standing in front of it.
And blocking out the stuff behind.
Exactly, which is a big step, because one of the things that sort of destroys the reality of AR is if you put your hand in front of your face, you know, you just see the object floating in front of your hand because your hand's in back of that image. But now with real body occlusion, it's a very, very big step, but I'm sure we'll be seeing versions of that for other platforms, because, you know, when you want to get to that world where we put on our goggles and we see each other and we really feel like we're in that environment. But the fact they can do that on a phone right now is pretty amazing.
Yeah. Well, what's funny is for the last 5-10 years, we've graded everything with the proviso of like, and it's done on a phone. Increasingly, as they become, you know, supercomputers, that becomes the least impressive part of the story, right? Like, instead, it just becomes like they're able to do this, this, and that, and it doesn't matter that it's on a phone.
I mean, certainly there's just the idea of doing it or having it available, and AR is one of those technologies that has yet to fully, I think, find a home, because we have yet to fully find exactly how we want to use it.
Along that line, tell us about your new toy, Andrew.
So Oculus unveiled two new developments. One was improvement on Rift, a new headset for the Rift. The other one is their standalone, their first 6 degree of freedom standalone, which is the Oculus Quest, which retails for $400. And the only other, I think, 60F is the, I have over here, was the Google Daydream, which was, you know, pretty cool, but it had one controller and it didn't have, I wouldn't say as much power or as capability as maybe it could have. The Quest functions much like a regular Oculus. You've got your two controllers with feedback, whatever. This is all standalone. There's no PC to hook this up to. There's nothing you have to do. You don't have any, like, with Vive, you don't have any lighthouses. It uses cameras here, here, here on the sides to track your environment around you. When you put it on, you use a controller to map out your space, you know, in your environment, to say, this is where my no-go zone is. And from there, you're fully immersed. Now, I have a lot of different, you know, gear. I've been buying, you know, headsets and VR stuff back since I had a Nintendo Virtual Boy. I had the original Oculus developer kit and played with that in Unity and Real and whatnot. So I've been following this for a while and waiting for that moment where I go, okay, this is the, we'll call it like the iPad moment. You know, you had, Microsoft had tablets, there were things back in the 90s. You know, you had the Newtons, General Magic, all that sort of stuff. But finally, when the iPad came out, you're like, okay, this is it. You know, this really solidifies what we're looking for. And I think for VR, this may be it. I've played with this. I played several hours of this, the Quest, and I love it. I think that it's, the tracking is fantastic. The controllers are wonderful. Now, if you have a PC system and you're already doing Vive or Oculus on there, the graphics are a downgrade. It's using a mobile processor for the graphics. So I think for people who already have those systems, might be like, oh, I prefer my PC system. But being untethered and whatnot, amazing.
So, much to my surprise, we just watched the B-roll of the marketing for this, and everything still took place inside a room. It seems to me the real value of this, because I think I'm 100% on board. I'm a happy Vive enthusiast, but I think I would immediately buy this if there were 5 games that encouraged me to run outside. And I understand there are tremendously... there's all kinds of security concerns or whatever, but I remember there was an app, Zombies Run, that was purely audio based, and it would track how fast you were jogging, and then if it felt like you were jogging underneath the level you should be, you would hear zombies coming up and a radio would come on and be like, oh my gosh, runner, they're coming up behind you, you got to keep on going or whatever. It seems to me that's the real value in this. If you can somehow keep me safe from cars, from obstacles, from whatever, and meanwhile I'm just running in circles around my neighborhood with this thing over my head, but it's in a fantasy world where I'm either chasing down Pokemon or running from zombies or whatever, that feels like, yeah, like that's a slam dunk. I would do that in a second. I don't care how high quality the visuals are.
So here's the challenge for the Quest. Doing it outdoors, they have what's called arena mode. So there is a mode in the developer mode where you can do arena mode, which is a very wide open landscape. I think the real challenge is just that because the sensors use infrared, is for the camera to be able to see where your hand sensors are. But people have been using this outdoors, and I'll find another link for you, and people have been using it outdoors and whatnot. So you're watching a guy playing this in a very large environment out in the field.
Now, it looks like they're using an AR type of experience, not a VR experience. Is that right, Andrew? Because it's
No,
it looks totally VR. I guess that's the question is my guess is they're going to be slow to roll this out because of the safety concerns.
How is it going to know anyone's around you or express that information?
Well, I think, you know, if if Brian were satisfied with running around a track, you know, then you can do what Brian wants to do now. I think the larger security question is, like, if you want to run on the side of the road, if you want to run on your sidewalk, then obviously there is going to be, you know, certain safety measures that will have to be in place before that's anything advertised or marketed, at least. But I think the idea, as soon as you untether it from a larger machine, then yeah, a lot of outdoor stuff is now possible, and will only continue to get more interesting, because $400 is, you know, that's a price point that will get a couple people in a field doing something, right? You know, if it gets down to, you know, 100, 200, now you really have, you know, a bigger kind of thing.
Well, and keep in mind, it was on this very podcast that Andrew was speculating, what, 5-6 years ago, the idea that we could go to Zilker Park and that all of us could have a 5-on-5 role play fantasy weapon extravaganza, and we would just have VR seeing something much more spectacular than the play pretend environment in our heads.
Now, what's cool with these things is they can network, and you can have multiple people in the same room playing it. And it's like when we did the Void experience. The Void was cool, but our reaction was kind of like, well, this is the same hardware people have in their homes, and you know, the advantage here is you just have a larger space to walk around in. Now, you know, I played the game of Vader Immortal, which was a collaboration of Oculus and XILM, or Lucasfilm's, you know, VR lab. And I loved it. It was amazing. You know, I'm in Darth Vader's castle. I'm fighting with lightsabers. I'm fighting robots and stuff. It's an immersive story thing that's coming out in multiple parts. And I can replay it. And was that as, you know, the only difference between that experience and playing The Void with my friends was The Void was with my friends. But if you can let my friends play that game with me, you know, I'm not big on the whole idea of destination VR or being on the high end, but I am big on the idea of like VR dojos and, you know, the idea of like, you know, just Brian has over at his, you know, compound has a space that's a VR space.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, now that I'm thinking about it, I could totally see. So imagine the default option is you spend $50 a month for a gym membership. So instead of spending that and then having to decide for yourself to go or whatever, what if there's a $50 membership, a commitment device that you make financially, and you can earn all that $50 back and then some just by scoring points in this app. So it's like you have committed to putting $50 out there, and then as much or as little as you feel like it, you go hunting and you put on the Oculus Quest, you run outside, you jump, you shoot, you roll, you burn the right number of calories, and then guess what? You get a refund of everything you committed. And you're subsidized. Your experience is subsidized by all the people who weren't as serious about getting fit as you were. And then you have like a freestanding market that shifts over time.
Yeah, or just at the very least, it's just very least like building like gyms and like you just pay a membership fee and you know that you and your friends can go in there and have a wider open space with multiple levels or things designed for stuff. You know, I think that just that alone, like, again, this, the free range aspect, if you want to get into VR, and I highly recommend the Quest to anybody who's curious to play with it. And again, like I said, if you're coming already from the Vive or Oculus with the PC, the downgrade for you is the graphics aren't as intensive as that is. But I think this is the future for all of that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, number one, the processing will only continue to get better and better. And also VR to me is about feeling in the moment, you know, and if this gives you, if it's easier now to do that without worrying about tripping over stuff like you do with the Vive with the cord, mm-hmm. then that's awesome. I do wonder though, you know, I think that the most exciting thing is what you were talking about, Andrew, that there could be these spaces where it's like, oh, cool. Like, you know, on Wednesdays, they always run groups for certain game or they're gonna bring in this and they're gonna rearrange their large room so it's better or optimized for this one experience. There's one of my favorite things to do in San Francisco is closing, actually. It's this gigantic immersive theater thing called the Speakeasy, which on one hand is always great because they you have all these great actors, and it's this play that you follow whoever you want through this one night at a 1920s speakeasy. But on the other hand, the really cool thing that I always liked about it is that they just created a great immersive environment. And you have to wonder, what is the scale down? I mean, they're closing because it's really expensive to own that place and pay all those actors and keep the liquor license if you're not running it as like a bar or a restaurant every night. So what is the sustainable scaled down version of that where it's like, hey, look, let's just throw on these things. And now, you know, it's a crazy horror murder mystery one night. And then it's a big, awesome paintball kind of experience on Tuesdays, and on Wednesdays it's secret ninja day. Like, it's,
yeah, thinking about, like, you combine that with the escape room kind of thing, and you could, like, oh, we could borrow a space, a hotel or whatever, and give people a tour of the Titanic, and then you end up in a small room and you take it off and it looks like a private dining room, and you have a dinner, you know, then you put your headgear back on and go back through and take another tour of the Titanic or some lost thing, and you can mix real world elements with, you know, the virtual. And I think, yeah, the kind of experiences could be amazing. You know, you look at.
I would bet this is a Vegas. This sounds like a Vegas idea, because there's like nothing but space and warehouse space close to where you could do stuff, if not like really close to the strip or downtown, where you could do something really, really awesome with these.
So I'm taking a step farther, and I'm thinking about like payment models or monetization. Like, what if you did. Let's say you didn't even want to spend $50 a month on some kind of virtual gym membership and earn your money back. What if instead you wanted to either get paid or earn the right to have your Oculus Quest for free? We could call it Quality Quest or whatever, where your job is to, if you get 500 quality credits, then you get to keep having your Oculus Quest for free, but your quality credits are earned by you physically running to different places where you're given an A-B test of, like, which is the cooler title, Titan Station or Station Omega? And then you pick. And what you're really doing is you're essentially becoming a test audience for somebody else's project, and you don't even know what the project is. But meanwhile, the benefit you're getting is you're burning calories and earning points that keep you in your free Oculus Quest.
You know, that's an interesting idea. I was actually thinking, like, if you had, like, the game that we were watching on the B-roll was a kind of paintball-esque sort of, like, people shooting at each other, I assume eliminating each other. Like, are we at a point now where if these avatars that are, you know, like, physical and real and you know it's your friends, how far away are we from, like, just low-scale, highly commoditized just endorsements? That, hey, would you like $5 to make sure that your avatar in this game just wears a gigantic Visa logo, and now you're like, you're just buying into endorsements where it's like, oh, cool, I get paid. It's nothing, right?
Well,
you can do it just for like to look cool.
Oculus, you know, those rebels there, it's not like they're backed by Facebook, which would, you know, try to.
Exactly.
Yeah, yes to everything. I highly, highly recommend this, though. I have not been this delighted with the VR thing since, like, I first played the Vive, and I remember telling you guys, like, oh, you got to try Six Degrees of Freedom, guys. You got to try this. And we're all like, well, I've done VR. Like, no, not like this. And then you do it, and it's like, it's amazing. And this, without the cables, without all that, and, you know, I put Tilt Brush Hand on it, told my girlfriend, hey, why don't you try this? 45 minutes later, I'm watching her play with my VR gear, and like, why did I let her do this? You know, it's that kind of experience. And I'll tell you what's cool too is what's come a long ways now is web-based experiences. There's a framework called A-Frame, allows you to take basically do JavaScript sort of 3D virtual reality stuff. And so there's a game called like Moonbeam Rider, I think it is, which is browser-based. You put on the Oculus. You open up the browser and you click on Moonrider. There you go. And it's basically like a Beat Saber knockoff, but it's done completely across the web through a browser.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And just to see what's, you know, possible with that is incredible, because you're like, wow, this is all web-based. And there's actually networked A-Frame. Like, so you could, you know, I could create a site that, you know, my friends could go into a 3D environment and I could send you links and we could all meet up in there, and totally without having to download any software, just browser-based alone. So It's very, very exciting. That was my pick.
Ah, shoot. Oh, we're picks. Picks already.
Hey, I saw three movies on the flight back.
Go on.
I saw Venom, which I fell asleep during. I don't know how much of that was the fact that Venom was kind of a boring movie. And how much of it was because I was on an international flight.
So anyway, Justin, I just want to let you know very directly, I am an alien that speaks English and inhabiting your body right now. Let me explain 27 more points to the plot of all this and then give you direct instructions on how to handle the end of it. It's me, Venom. What's going on?
Yeah, you're not wrong. There's a lot of that.
Listen, I was listening to Night Attack, where what I'm doing right now is exactly what you said would make a good movie. So how do you feel about it now, me, Venom?
It kind of gets everything that I like about the symbiote wrong. I mean, I don't know. I guess Venom's such a weird character, because I think the reason why some people like it is, you know, just a purely sort of physical, you know, just like looking like, oh, cool, gigantic, roided out Venom with sharp teeth eating people is like cool. It's like badass. It's like something you want to draw in your notebook or like have on a heavy metal album cover.
Yeah, it's almost like I'm a physical manifestation of your rage made flesh, and you wish that you could experience that rage made flesh, but what you don't necessarily want is a constant dialogue in your ear explaining to you how I am rage made flesh. Anyway, it's me, Venom. Don't worry about it. Continue with your podcast.
Yeah. All right, so anyway, I fell asleep during Venom, and Woody Harrelson's wig in the after credit sequence is ridiculous. It is a ridiculous, like, I have no idea. It's and beyond the fact that if they're going to do Carnage in another Venom thing, then would it be crazy to just have the plot, you know, every once in a while just be like, oh, there's a murderer on the loose. Like, and then the murderer gets caught. And then eventually you find out that it's, what is it, Colin Cassidy, the Venom? Anyway, or the Carnage. Long story short, I fell asleep during that. I did watch Bohemian Rhapsody, which I really, really liked a lot more than I thought I was going to. I really had heard that it was kind of trash. And look, it is very biopic-y. It is right down. It's got all the biopic stuff, you know, right down to the troubled relationship with the father and the secret that will eventually be the undoing. But really my one review of Bohemian Rhapsody, beyond enjoying it as, you know, as a plain movie, is they really, really went for it with that Wayne's World joke. Middle of a movie about
what? About
oh no, Brian, there's a moment in the movie where a record producer being played by Mike Myers in heavy prosthetics is arguing that Bohemian Rhapsody will never be released as a single, and says, why don't you do I'm in love with my car? That's the kind of song that a bunch of teenagers could roll their windows down and sing along with.
Oh my God.
Okay. I mean, look, at the end of the day, that's the reason why I like Queen. I like Queen because I love Bohemian Rhapsody in Wayne's World. It turned me on to the band, which I eventually loved. So I guess it was like interesting that it felt that strongly about it to have Mike Myers remind you that he made Wayne's World.
Well, especially because, like, at the time, he was ashamed that they were putting Wayne's World stuff in the video that of Bohemian Rhapsody. He felt like it was a violation of everything that was awesome of Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah. So there's that. And then I watched Fighting With My Family, the WWE movie about the star Paige, and that was not great, even as a movie that like to that could explain kind of wrestling. Although very fun pairing of Nick Frost and Lena Headley as her parents that are real life people, real life wrestling promoters in England, and their portrayals are so spot on that they then start playing clips from a documentary that was made about the family, and you realize that some of the more outrageous, ridiculous lines that are in the movie are like literal things that were said by these two people on this documentary. So that was fun.
Dude, I've watched so much stuff over the last 2 weeks. It's, you know what's rad? I highly recommend getting an 11-year-old who expresses an active interest in learning what movies she needs to have seen. We watched Close Encounters of the Third Kind. We watched Poltergeist. She binged both seasons of Stranger Things. We ended up starting on Logan last night. It's so much fun to be able to be the Sherpa to explain to a kid what's clever about X, Y, and Z. But my pick is a little movie that I watched just for me, just for yours truly, a little movie called Deadwood. You ever hear of it?
Oh, it's out.
Yep, it's out, and it's great. Let me qualify that. If you have spent a decade waiting for closure, congratulations. It's here and waiting for you. And it's done a great job of reminding you of why things are the way they are and why you should feel the way you feel. It's delightful and wonderful. And I guess I read in an article that David Milch is descending into Alzheimer and dementia. It makes it all the more bittersweet. So when I was bursting out in tears, it was for many reasons, both for the fact that the world moves on, both for the thankfulness of, three seasons of this wonderful story, and for the fact that its creator is descending away.
Yeah, and David Milch famously hasn't always been the clearest vessel, even when he was a younger man.
Oh, he earned his destination.
a guy who, NYPD Blue was his big break, and that wound up kind of descending to the point where he just wouldn't write scripts. He would just tell the actors on set what to say because he was, substance abuse and stuff like that. So Deadwood to me is really his masterwork in terms of like really leaning into his flair for kind of like a stylized dialogue and creating this like version of the Old West that, you know, may or may not be realistic, but you feel it feels authentic.
I was so thankful when I threw out the call of I wanted somebody who hadn't seen Deadwood to watch Deadwood, and Bryce volunteered his tribute. And and instantly, like 20 minutes in, he's like, yay, verily, what the F word? I don't understand why people talk this way. And I was like, oh, forgot to mention.
Yeah. All of that, like, because I had been listening to you, because you guys watched Deadwood on Cord Killers, and none of all the things that I thought I knew about Deadwood, I thought they speak like they're in a Shakespeare play would have been something I picked up.
Yeah.
It's a Shakespeare play with a few choice curse words kind of thrown in. But that's David Milch. And look, when you get the reason why Deadwood's special for him is that you get something that felt pretty real, but had this fanciful element that never distracted from it in a way that some of his other stuff, like John from Cincinnati, for example, it's just that's all extravagance. That's all ridiculousness. And even if you like the show, it's like there's nothing authentic about it. Nothing feels real about it.
I have a pick. I'm going to talk about it very broadly because I know Brian's only just started it. And
10 minutes in.
It's about 10 minutes in. And I think that even though they are selling the thing about this game pretty upfront, I think I went into it not knowing anything about it other than it had just come out and had a really fun time playing it. It's this new game from Annapurna called Outer Wilds. I'll explain the very beginning, right? You wake up under the stars and you see the planets and you can see the sky is moving super fast because it's, you know, it's a video game. So the day and night cycle is super fast. And you're in this village and you go and you talk to everyone and they let you know, oh, yeah, hey, you're the astronaut. Congrats. Wait, good. You're up. Hey, you're going to go out into space today. And, they go through the tutorial stuff. You're like, oh, you know, you can play the lander. You can do the zero G stuff. It's a space exploration game. And one of the people you talk to is like, hey, what are you going to do when you get out into space? and you could do anything. You're not given a plan. You're not given anything to do. And you get out there and you start to explore the, you know, it's about 6 planets or so, and you find a very compelling thing. You find a very good story there. And there's a lot of really, it's very good.
I'll tell you this much. Yeah. I'm utterly entranced in just the first 10 minutes.
And yeah, you have not even gotten off the planet.
I've not gotten off the planet, but just the casualness, you know, you walk up and you look down, you're like, oh, these are all aliens. And you look down at your hands, you're like, oh, I guess I'm an alien. Mm-hmm, and you're like, who am I? Where am I? And it's like, well, everybody seems real friendly and proud of me. And I guess I better practice this lunar lander thing before I guess I take off or whatever. The kids are super all in. I'm all in. And I get the vibe that it's something I should share with the kids. Is that
accurate? Yeah, you can share it with them. Yeah. It has some narrative stuff into it. It has some very minor action-y stuff to it, but I think most people could play it and get through the thing that it's doing. And it's really smart in the way that it does some of the stuff. This just came out, so I really don't want to talk openly about it. But this is
would it be fair to say this feels like the video game equivalent of like the movie Moon? It feels like an indie movie that happens to be a video game, or the video game Firewatch, where it's like I'm really excited to uncover a deeper story.
I would even say it's closer to it's a little bit like Firewatch, but I think it's closer to like a classic point and click adventure game. I mean, it is, you are uncovering different parts of the world,
more like the Walking Dead adventures.
No, because I think even that is still very like when you get out into space in this game, it's open. You go anywhere and do whatever you'd like in whatever order, or like Myst, I guess. It feels very, very similar to Myst, but you have free controls. You have a jetpack. You have oxygen, and you're doing these jetpack bits. It's very cool, and it has some like real science in it. I don't know if you get to the museum in the village, but there's real Earth science that your kids will learn at least a little bit.
Outer Wilds. You can get this on the Epic Games Store right now. They're offering like $10 off. We are not sponsored by this, but I think it's defaulted at $25, but I think it's only $15 if you buy it right now.
And it's on Xbox and the Xbox Game Pass. So if you have that, it's also free for you there.
And my provisional endorsement is based on 10 minutes of the first beginning of
Well, yeah, yeah. And I know Brant is also huge into it too. He's a couple hours in. So Outer Wilds, please, just a blind faith recommendation if you like video games.
Excellent. Like I said, my pick is The Quest. Take a look at it. If you're into VR, check it out. And I want to say that the amount of hardware, the amount of capability they're able to put into a $400 device, it's very clear that Facebook is selling these probably razor thin margins, if at all. I mean, it is, you know, the controllers have, I was surprised they had vibrating feedback on them. The room scale sensing is incredible. There's a $400 version one and a $500 one. The difference is storage, just if you don't want to have to, you know, offload games, but doesn't affect performance or anything. So probably the $400 one's the most sensible option for most people.
And the thing that surprises me and I think is worth noting is because they had the Oculus Go before this, right, which was also a standalone, but this is the library of this is not the Go games. This is closer to the Rift games, where they are like Beat Saber's on here, Super Hot's on here, you know, more bigger experiences and not the like little mobile phone experiences that the other standalone VR systems have been using right now, right?
Yeah, this is the Go. The Go is cool, but the Go is, it's not 6 degrees of freedom. It's, you know, your head's on a swivel looking around, and the controller is just sort of the point click. So yeah, you're getting games that were designed more for like the desktop, you know, Rift games are being ported over to it because it has it not the same processing power as far as, you know, the desktop. Sure. Because it's, you know, trying to compete with the PC with the graphics cards hard, but capabilities, you walk around, like I said, 6 degrees of freedom. If you have a large space, you just walk around your space and you're in there. If you're in a spaceship, like, you know, playing Vader Immortal, you walk around the space and you feel like you're in there. And the controllers, the feedback, it's the same thing. It senses where they are in space. So it's pretty much the exact same experience you get in a Vive or Oculus. The only difference is just, you know, the graphics are a little bit more simpler in this.
Yeah. The price, every time I hear it, is crazy to me because it also includes the wireless remotes and stuff. That stuff is so expensive on the wired one. Wow.
I think they're planning to make a big bet on this. I think this may become the default platform.
Wow.
That would be great.
Cool. All right, folks. It's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.